I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The battle against ISIS, the recent Israel election, nuclear talks with Iran, and the U.S. military exit from Afghanistan. President Obama has had his hands full of high-stakes foreign policy issues, as well as efforts by congressional Republicans to challenge some of his initiatives. In this first hour of Midday, a look at the struggle between Congress and the president over the deal to limit Iran's nuclear program, and Mr. Obama's request for formal authorization to fight the Islamic State. Plus, the future of Israel-Palestine peace efforts in the wake of the recent Israel elections. Our guests, Max Hilaire, professor and chair of political science at Morgan State University, and presidential historian Richard Striner of Washington College. First, the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. It's a two-hour show, as usual. In the second hour of our show today, we take a look at one of many trends in social media, apps that hide the identities of people who post all kinds of racist, misogynistic, homophobic, and abusive comments. These are anonymous, hyper-local apps that are quite popular now, especially on college campuses. Joining us in the second hour will be Danielle Citron, who is a University of Maryland law professor who has become quite the leading expert on hate crimes in cyberspace. She's much sought after and has published one book and working on another on that subject. And Issy Lepowski will be with us. She is a tech trend reporter for Wired. That's in the second hour of our show today, Yik Yak and the Culture of Anonymous Hyperlocal Speech on the Internet. In this hour of the show, we focus on foreign policy. There's already a lot of talk, some of it on Midday, about the 2016 presidential election. Some of that results, of course, from the actions and words of Maryland's former governor, Martin O'Malley, who seems to be campaigning more earnestly for the job, making more visits to key early primary states. And Sunday on ABC's This Week, he took a swipe at likely contenders Hillary Rodham Clinton and Jeb Bush, saying that, quote, the presidency of the United States is not some crown to be passed between two families, end quote. Mr. O'Malley's challenge to Mrs. Clinton prompts an interesting question for the coming year. With the U.S. economy in slow recovery, will foreign policy experience, knowledge, and interest in affairs of state be more of a factor in the electorate's mind and in its decision-making in 2016 in the presidential election? I ask because of the news of late, a 10-car pileup of international matters, the battle against the Islamic State in Syria, in Iraq, the recent Israel election, nuclear talks with Iran, and the U.S. military exit from Afghanistan. President Obama has had his hands full of high-stakes foreign policy issues, as well as efforts by congressional Republicans to publicly challenge some of his initiatives. While Hillary Clinton served as Secretary of State, neither Martin O'Malley nor Jeb Bush, like many other governors before them who ran for president, have foreign policy experience. The question is, will that experience give Mrs. Clinton the edge if she seeks the presidency, as she is expected to? Recent events also highlight the enormous challenges facing the American president, both externally and internally, in a changing world. In this hour of Midday, a look at the struggle between Congress and the White House over international matters, the U.S. strategy on ISIS, the president's request for full congressional authorization to wage battle with the Islamic State, and the future of Israel-Palestine peace efforts in the wake of the recent re-election of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was invited to speak before Congress, of course, during his campaign, something considered a slap at President Obama. Mr. Netanyahu also rejected a proposed two-state solution, something Mr. Obama believes is necessary for peace. We also had 47 members of the Senate going over Mr. Obama's head, sending an open letter to the leaders of Iran to say that any deal limiting Iran's nuclear power program would have to be approved by Congress. Virtually, very few times in history have we seen anything like this. The U.S. News and World Report quoting experts who say it's rare that members of the legislative branch do something quite as audacious as that. And in a brief and academically sketchy explainer of the U.S. Constitution, those 47 senators informed Iran that any deal could be undone with the stroke of a pen by the next president. So I've set the table there. A lot to talk about in this hour, and we have two excellent guests, Max Hilaire, professor and chair of the political science department at Morgan State University, I'm happy to say, is back with us. Max, nice to see you again.
Thank you very much.
And presidential historian and professor of history, Richard Striner of Washington College, back in Studio A with us as well today. Nice to see you, Richard.
Great to be here, Dan.
Max, I'll start with you, and you can start anywhere you like. It just seems like the way I've sort of set this up is, you know, looking ahead to 2016, I don't know if we can talk about this a little bit today. We don't know who the candidates are going to be, of course. But, you know, you look at the pileup of international issues, indeed crises, and you must say that looking down the road, the next president is going to have to, if Mr. Obama doesn't fix any of these or settle any of these things, which seems unlikely, the next president certainly will have to.
Well, certainly the next president is going to have his hands full from day one when he takes office. And I remember the statement Senator Clinton made during the campaign in 2008, saying that at 3 o'clock when the phone rings, what would Obama do?
Yeah.
And I think that could be said for anyone. Much of the problems going on in the Middle East and elsewhere are problems external to the United States president or the United States government. Some of these problems go back 500 years, 1,000 years. These are not problems the United States can simply interject itself in and resolve overnight. They require concerted effort, multilateral engagement, tremendous resources, patience, and of course, an understanding of these problems, which in most cases are not military or security in the traditional sense, but these are political, social, economic, religious, sectarian problems that simply one country or the Western world is not going to be able to solve as one would expect.
Richard, what are your reflections on all that I put forward, and then we'll go through each of these issues individually?
Well, I agree with a great deal that Max just said. Certainly, many of these problems do go back hundreds, thousands of years. On the other hand, some changes and crises erupt, you know, very suddenly, and quick reactions are sometimes called for. I agree that much of the time there's a limit to what the United States can do. There's a limit to what any number of collaborating nations can do about a particular problem, and that often patience, wisdom, collaborative effort is needed. But I think that sometimes audacity is needed. Sometimes military action can be very effective. And sometimes one nation can make a great deal of difference. It depends on the precise challenge, how it erupts, who's in charge, how much information they have, how wise they are.
Your evaluation of President Obama on foreign affairs generally. I mean, the first term obviously was absorbed with the economy, with the Affordable Care Act, big domestic issues, big domestic problems in one sense, the recession and all. So here's the second term, and this seems to be a pattern with presidents who serve a second term, that they turn more toward foreign affairs because they, in the first term, they made so many promises on the domestic front.
Well, I think one could agree the president did accomplish some. Had some accomplishments in foreign affairs in the first term, the nuclear agreement with Russia. At least one of the biggest challenges is basically mending the relationship of the United States with other countries, the reputation of the United States after the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was really bad, particularly in the Middle East, and also our relationship with our allies in Europe and with Russia. When President Obama came in, and I think that's with every president who comes into office, there are tremendous expectations in terms of what the president can do, particularly in changing the foreign affairs direction of the country. And I think what many don't realize, American foreign policy seldom changes from administration to administration. There may be some changes in style, but in terms of substance, it doesn't really change. And I think what President Obama is suffering from and what any future president is going to suffer from is what was inherited at the end of the Cold War. That we never quite articulated a post-Cold War foreign policy for the United States. Second of all, we have emerging powers. As President Obama said very well in his first inaugural address, the world has changed and we must change with it. We are yet to realize the transformation that has taken place in the world, the rise of China, Brazil, South Korea, South Africa, even Russia. We've gone on this military campaign and build up our military forces, but wars don't solve all problems. And we've found ourselves fighting two wars, not with an equal military power. We're fighting an invisible enemy, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and we've done it for 13, 14 years. So what does military power mean? If you can defeat ragtag enemies like the Taliban or the insurgency in Iraq, so I think we need a new approach to foreign affairs. But first, maybe our leaders need a course in anthropology so they understand the nature of the world, the customs, values, and traditions of other people before we think the military is the solution to all problems. And,
Do you think Obama lived up to his promises on this?
I think in a certain...
Recognize the changing world?
Yes.
Do you see that in his policies?
I think he did in some respects, and I think the president exercised a degree of restraint in using military force unilaterally, given what happened in Iraq and, well, not so much in Afghanistan because we had a collision, but inheriting two wars that were becoming very unpopular, draining the U.S. Treasury, and heavily dependent on China to bankroll these wars. The president came in, inherited an economic situation in the country that was pretty close to the Great Depression. It's taken a long time. People are still out of work, people are still suffering, and the economic gap between rich and poor has expanded. So there's still a lot of work to be done. The infrastructure of this country is really down. And last of all, the educational standards in this country, which is what is going to define power in the 21st century, is not even up to par with South Korea, Hong Kong, China, Japan, and even the Netherlands.
All right, Richard, we'll go back to you to my question about, you know, sort of your overall review of Obama in foreign policy. What do you think of the president's conduct of foreign affairs? And we can get into specifics after our first break here. But your general thoughts on his 1.5 terms?
I think he's done all right in foreign policy. I don't think he's made major mistakes. I think he has made major mistakes in domestic policy. I agree with some of what Max said about the overall situation of the United States in the first decades of this century. I have different views in other ways. I agree that we did not do a good job in the 1990s of developing a strategic vision following the end of the Cold War. To the contrary, there was this fatuous triumphalism and drift at the time. And there was so much that we might have done, you know, in sort of a Marshall Plan effort to reach out to Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We didn't. We were almost inviting a reversion to autocracy. I wrote at the time, generations may curse us down the years for this. There were a lot of mistakes made then. And then came 9/11. A whole new era in national security for us, just like the advent of nuclear power forced a whole new long-term strategic architecture in the Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy years. A lot of things had to be looked at afresh, and a lot of what was considered and decided then is still classified. A lot of what is being considered and done now is of necessity classified and has to be classified. But there is a desperate round-the-clock effort being made. Someday, perhaps, the full story can be told to protect us from fanatics who want to spill our blood right here in this land using every possible device of infiltration to do it without let-up. And I don't take anything for granted. in a situation like that. I disagreed with George W. Bush on the Iraq War. The pretext was flimsy. The war itself was badly handled. But continuing U.S. presence in a number of countries to protect us at the far frontiers of the terrorism challenge, oh, I think it's absolutely essential, and it has to be fundamentally military.
Then when we get back, we'll talk about the president's approach on ISIS, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, his request to Congress for full authorization of that. But also, speaking of Congress, a couple of slaps at our president from the Congress on foreign matters. We'll talk about that as well after a short break here. Richard Schreiner, a presidential historian and professor of history at Washington College, and Max Hilaire, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, our guests. 410-662-8780 to join our conversation. We'll continue that conversation in a moment, but if you'd like to comment on anything you hear us talking about in this hour of the show on foreign policy, 410-662-8780 is the number to call, or send me an email with comments or a question for our guests, midday@wypr.org. Richard Schreiner visiting us again from Washington College and Max Hilaire from Morgan State University. Two other things we wanted to talk about today was the, first of all, the letter the 47 senators wrote, an open letter to the leaders of Iran, warning them that any deal the White House worked out on limitations to Iran's nuclear program would be subject to congressional approval, could be nixed by the next president. That was considered a slap at President Obama. And then we had the invitation by John Boehner to bring Prime Minister Netanyahu over to give a speech to Congress about Iran and nuclear power and Israel, also considered a slap at President Obama. Don in Parkville wanted to make a comment about this, and since we're going to be talking about it, we welcome you into the show. Don, go right ahead.
Okay, three comments. Partly related to the American culture, Americans are very impatient. We would like to see decisions and actions taken very quickly with the results very quickly, which is not possible in the Middle East or internationally. Second is, we're also very geographically and internationally ignorant, so we don't understand different cultures, value systems, political motivations. And the third one I would note, and to me this is more serious, I see the opposition to Obama and foreign policy just an extension of the opposition in domestic. Early on, before Obama even became president, Grover Norquist, an unelected Republican leader, said we're not going to allow him to be president. And I think that same sort of attitude is now reflected in the letter and the other opposition to his international actions.
Okay, thank you very much, Don. That gets us rolling on that then. We'll move right into that subject then. Why don't we talk about this here? Because we haven't had a chance, I haven't had a chance to on midday since these two things happened. One, the open letter from these 47 senators, which may be forgotten now, but nonetheless, it's worth talking about, and also the invitation to Netanyahu.
Well, I think two things. One, the invitation in itself, I think, was a slap in the face to the president, particularly where the president is negotiating, or the United States is negotiating, a very critical national security issue at a multilateral level, not bilateral, and then we invite a foreign leader who is strongly opposed to any deal whatsoever with Iran to come and speak before the most important body of government of the United States. I thought that was pretty bad on the part of Speaker Boehner to invite Netanyahu at this time, particularly while the talks are still ongoing. Second, with the response, the letter written by 47 senators, I think the senators misunderstood their civic lessons in school, because certainly the president, whether it's President Reagan, who signed an executive agreement for the release of the hostages in exchange for a settlement with Iran over all outstanding issues, the so-called Algiers Accord, that was not a treaty. And in fact, it was challenged by Dims and Moore before the Supreme Court, claiming that the president had overstepped his authority as president, and the court upheld the executive agreement. Second, President Bush signed an executive agreement to repatriate U.S. troops out of Iraq and then to leave some, which President Obama finally completed. That was an executive agreement, not a treaty. Presidents under the executive authority always have had that leeway to sign executive agreements, and, you know, treaties are not the norm in international affairs because they take a very long time, and even putting a treaty before Congress for advice and consent could take an indefinite period, like we see with so many other treaties lingering before Congress.
So this is just an agreement.
It's an executive agreement, not a treaty, and it would have the strength of domestic law, like a treaty or a congressional statute. Now, Congress could have a joint statement claiming that they would like to see XYZ in that agreement, or Congress can exercise its legislative authority and
but what was the point? What was the point of this Republican letter?
I think much of it had to do with the few Republican aspirants who want to be president of the United States.
Richie, let's hear from you on this. First, let's talk about Israel and the Netanyahu invitation just before the election to speak to Congress.
Well, the Netanyahu invitation is part of the same campaign that Max was talking about, and I agree with him. I'd go further and say that while there certainly is an important fundamental role for Congress to play in foreign policy, and if there's a strong difference of opinion between the executive and legislative branches, sometimes many of us very much want to see Congress assert itself. In the Vietnam War, for example, you know, when J. William Fulbright and Wayne Morse and others began to become more and more assertive against the policies of the Johnson and Nixon administrations, I, for one, was glad. But there is a way to do things. And in the long and often glorious history of the Republican Party, there have been times for combat, times to take off the gloves, and there have been times to act with civility. And all I can say is that Dwight D. Eisenhower must be turning over in his grave, given the way Republicans are acting now. There are no words low enough to describe the behavior of most Republicans toward the Obama administration. They're a pack of hyenas. They will stop at almost nothing. And the whole way in which the situation has been handled is, in my opinion, disgusting.
Well, there's no substance here. Except to make a note to the leaders of Iran.
There may be substance. There are serious concerns, you know, with regard to this whole Iran nuclear business.
It's not clear from this letter.
Well, no. What I mean is there are serious concerns, but these people, in my judgment, are not serious. They're grandstanding. They're engaging in malicious payback.
And do you see the same thing in the invitation to Netanyahu to speak to Congress?
Oh, absolutely.
One thing I wonder about that was this unusual for the Israel. There's two things. The Israel prime minister basically aligning himself with the Republican Party, which is not something Israeli leaders have done in the past, aligned with either party one way or the other. They want to be an ally of the United States, right? So I noted that. And then also the statement just before the election, I think on the eve of the election, that he no longer supported a two-state solution, and then, Netanyahu, and then he tried to backtrack from that. So President Obama is left with what now? I mean, how do you negotiate a peace if one party says, I'm not interested in that? Do you say, well, it's just politics, that's just Netanyahu making sure he got reelected?
Well, you know, this two-state solution is not President Obama's policy. It's been that of President Bush and previous presidents. And I think President Obama made a very concerted effort to get this talk started soon after he took office, appointed Judge Mitchell. But I think all along, Netanyahu was not committed. He was forced to make a commitment to a two-state solution. But on one hand, Netanyahu is negotiating. On the other hand, he's undermining the negotiations by extending settlements, by taking measures that are totally intended to prolong this whole process. And I think Netanyahu never expected President Obama to get a second term, because he's always been closely identified with the Republicans' Republican Party. And I think what we are seeing now is a Netanyahu who used very racist tactics to get reelected by calling out the Palestinians as being, you know, almost non-Israeli, and then going before these settlements and taking photos to make the right believe, well, he's a much more committed person on the building of settlements, and then make the statement that he would never accept a two-state solution. It is just Netanyahu as it should have always been viewed. And I personally think the president should not waste his political capital in the last 2 years he has in office in trying to negotiate a deal with Netanyahu. There are better issues the president can seal a legacy on than try to bring about a Middle East peace that has escaped so many presidents in the past.
It's midday. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Dan Rodericks, that was Max Hilaire from Morgan State University, Richard Strine from Washington College. Your thoughts about this?
Oh, I agree. Where
they go now, I guess the question is, where do you go now?
It is probably a waste of time for Obama to try to do much of anything with Netanyahu, except to give him the cold shoulder and leave it at that. The Iranian issue, though connected to Israel and Netanyahu, is very important, and this effort is ongoing, and we'll see how it works out. As to the Israeli situation generally, taking the long view, I don't know if there will ever be a decent solution to the Israel-Palestine problem. Centuries ahead may show that the situation is truly hopeless. I don't know. The United States and other nations and people of goodwill, you know, have to do what they can to try to limit the bloodshed and hatred. I don't know if there is a viable solution.
Well, I think we're seeing, Dan, is the European Union is moving closer to recognizing Palestine as a state. The Swedes have done so. The British House of Commons passed a measure calling on the British government to recognize the state of Palestine as a legitimate state. Palestine is likely to be given membership in the International Criminal Court, which they intend to use to bring charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity against Israel. And you have measures coming up before the United Nations Human Rights Council. And of course, the Security Council is looking closely at adopting a resolution that would call for a two-state solution and put forward a blueprint, which the United States could either abstain. In the past, the United States has used its veto 41 times to protect Israel. So the president could easily retaliate by simply abstaining on the resolution, or he has nothing to lose since he's not running for re-election, and take a bold stand and support the Security Council.
You're arguing that Palestine can say, well, we no longer have a serious negotiating partner in Netanyahu. He's not interested in this, so let's move along, and we wanted some sort of declaration from another authority, such as the UN.
They're getting it. In fact, again, as I said, they've been granted membership in UNESCO.
Yeah,
they're
being
granted membership in the International Criminal Court. More governments are recognizing Palestine. And I think it's just a matter of time before the General Assembly of the UN adopts a resolution recognizing Palestine as a state.
Thank you, Max. We'll take a little break here and come back and talk some more with Max Hilaire and Richard Strine. Our conversation continues in just a moment on Midday. First, a quick break. And back here on Midday with Richard Strine from Washington College and Max Hilaire from Morgan State University. You wanted to add something to our comments on peace in the Middle East, Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, well, as far as Palestine is concerned... You know, define Palestine. It's a question of who's in control there, what degree of legitimacy they have, what their policies are. Are we talking about Hamas? Are we talking about the remnants of PLO? Are we talking about, you know, some power yet to emerge? These are serious questions, and I have no answers. But if there are war crimes to be prosecuted in the long Israel-Palestine conflict, I think, you know, it's got to be double-sided.
I agree. Richard Strine, 410-662-8780 is our number. Now, moving elsewhere in the Middle East, ISIS, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. President Obama a few weeks ago asked Congress for authorization to fight this battle, even though we have already been fighting the battle to some extent. What do you think of this? What do you think of the president's handling of it so far? And is this a constitutional issue going to Congress? Some people think it's pro forma.
Well, it's pro forma, and I agree with the president. Politically, it's wise, but he's not going to get an authorization given that the ghost of 2001, when members of the Senate who had intended to run for president all of a sudden realized, oh, I made an error in supporting this authorization for use of military force.
You mean in Iraq?
In Iraq, yeah. And then it came back to hurt both Kerry and Hillary Clinton. So I think those who are particularly on the Republican side, and given the fact that some of them are just the animosity between them and the president, they are not likely to give him that authorization. I do believe it's pro forma, and the president is right that if you're taking the country into a military situation where there's tremendous uncertainty, and of course it's going to require a long-term commitment, that you need the support of the American public and the other wing of the United States government. But the president could have acted alone. He has the executive power. He has commander-in-chief power. And of course, he has his primary obligation is for the security and safety of the American people and the United States homeland. So the president really doesn't, and the existing authorization has not expired. The 2002 authorization never expired. So the president had opposed it initially, and he would like a new commitment. But I think some members of Congress really see it as a ploy and will not go along with it.
The president said, Richard Steiner, the world needs to know we are united behind this effort.
Meaning the effort to destroy ISIS.
ISIS, yeah.
Fine with me. I think Obama's been handling that situation quite well, and I think he's been handling the Russia-Putin situation reasonably well. Very different kinds of rapidly erupting threats, both sinister, quite different, but both demanding responses from civilized people, because if not countered, both of these forms of aggression could spread with astonishing speed and malevolence outward. The use of military force in our constitutional system has always been an iffy proposition short of a full-fledged declaration of war. And we have not had a declaration of war since World War II. I'm not sure if we ever will have another one. Perhaps after the 9/11 attacks, we should have. But since Jefferson sent the Marines after the Barbary Pirates, there have been occasions when the president, as commander-in-chief, uses military force advisedly. But when the scope and scale of the military action become serious enough, I think it is necessary to go to Congress and develop a consensus and get authorization.
One thing that's hard to gauge, unless you go by polls, I guess, is how the American people feel about any of this, and specifically an action that could involve the military again, post-Iraq, finally post-Afghanistan. It's been a long time, and we have an all-volunteer military. It's not as if we haven't had a draft since the Vietnam era, so people aren't as engaged as they would be if that were still the case. And, you know, do people still feel like there's a threat to the United States proper posed by terrorists around the world? Do we still have those fears? They certainly can't be as acute as they were post-9/11. Are they still there? Is it enough to make people, going back to the question I had at the beginning of the show, is this enough to stir people to vote? Is this something that will be even on voters' minds next year?
Well, it probably will. They're using fear to force people to, you know, consider one particular candidate over the other. Mm-hmm. May very well be the strategy used. It's not so much. And I don't think we should be complacent about the fact that terrorism is still an international threat. I think it's the strategy employed. You can't simply use military force to defeat an idea. Plus, you have people who are suicidal. There's not much we can do. I mean, look at the response to the downing of this Airbus F320, the German wing. I mean, are we going to react every time there's some kind of international crisis to change strategy? I mean, sometimes we're overreacting, and it seems like the terrorist is always a step ahead of us, because today the national security threat, broadly defined, is quite different than what it was pre-World War II or during World War II. I mean, when someone could use improvised explosive devices, use a mobile phone, use drones to carry out attacks, or even basic common sense issues, whether you enter a subway with an explosive or, you know, I mean, these are things that could disrupt a country very seriously. And also the whole issue of cyber attacks. I mean, you could cause as much damage to the American air traffic system or the ground transportation system or our telephone network or any number of issues in the United States. So it requires a lot of planning, a comprehensive counterterrorism strategy, and not just solely striking at various terrorist cells in one part of the world or the other.
And do you think Obama's adapted to this changing world and changing threats that Max defines?
Well, it's hard to say because a lot of this is classified.
Yeah, it's true.
And has to be classified.
What we see on the public record anyway. Well, ISIS, for instance.
Well, from what the press shows, it seems to me that he's playing the ISIS situation pretty well. But I'm very disturbed about shifts in public opinion with regard to national security. The use of fear, well, fear as a tactic can be misused by demagogues, of course. But I think we should be very afraid. There's a lot out there to be afraid of, and I think it's got to be intensely confronted. A lot of it confronted and dealt with secretly. Terrorists one step ahead of us? Well, I don't know. You know, this is a round-the-clock secret war. The terrorists certainly were one step ahead of us before 9/11. That didn't come from out of nowhere. But afterward, you know, there was a lot of justified finger-pointing about the signs that should have been seen. Intelligence failures, breakdowns, big topic.
I'm tempted to ask you, Richard Schreiner, how you felt about revelations about the National Security Agency and the collections of massive amounts of domestic data.
I'm glad you asked me that question. Now, governmental authority can always be abused. You look at what the CIA and FBI did, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, MK Ultra and the COINTELPRO, you know, the tapping of Martin Luther King. Of course, there has to be oversight. Oversight can be evaded. It's nothing to be complacent about. But this all or nothing, you know, libertarian mindset when Snowden began to leak the stuff. These national security bad guys, you know, invading our privacy. I want NSA on the job. Our lives depend upon it. You know, every time for a while after 9/11, every time I drove over that Bay Bridge commuting from where I live to Chestertown, where I teach, I thought to myself, it wouldn't take much to bring this thing down. Just the right amount of explosive put in the weakest point of the structure, and there it goes. They've got to be monitoring that. Are they? They must be. How? I don't know. I shouldn't know. Are they monitoring it?
I know for a time they stopped people who were taking videos of the bridge, some while they were in a car or
this
truck driving
ongoing.
Over
this is ongoing. Do you remember that article in
there
the New
Yorker?
There
was some racial profiling in that, too.
In 2005, I think it was, about the U.S. ports facility slipping into foreign ownership and how easy it would be for a rogue freighter to bring a small nuclear device into Brooklyn, mm-hmm. Port of Baltimore, detonate it.
So you don't have a problem with what Dutch Ruppersberger, the congressman, said. In order to find the needle in the haystack, you need the haystack, referring to the massive
amount of data
collection that the NSA...
A lot of people are living in a fantasy world of denial.
Max, you have a comment about that?
Well,
Richard, because...
The National Security Agency revealed recently much of that bulk data has not led to any substantive intelligence information. But going back to ISIS, Dan, I think if you look, what this has done is created some strange alliances in terms of the U.S. and Iran fighting alongside Iraq. and you have Sunnis fighting Shiites. The Iraqi army is predominantly Shiite, fighting to liberate Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, which is predominantly Sunni. And then you have the Saudis bombing Yemen, supported by the Houthis, are supported by Iran. So you ask,
there's some Christian militia you can throw into that.
Yes, and then you look at Syria, where the United States is somewhat in alliance with Assad, bombing territory captured by ISIS. So you said, this is a real milieu, and how do we get out of it with a stable Middle East and the United States reputation intact?
We don't get out of it.
We don't get it. You say we're in for the long term.
That's right.
Richard Striner, presidential historian and professor of history at Washington College, joins us from time to time to talk politics and give a historical perspective to current events. Richard, nice to have you back on the show.
Always great to be here.
Thank you for being here. And Max Hilaire, who is chair of the political science department at Morgan State, also joins us from time to time to talk about foreign affairs and some national affairs, too. Great to have you with us.
Thanks,
Max.
Thanks
very much. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our first hour of Midday. Today, we've got another hour ahead for you coming up after the news from NPR at 1 o'clock. Right now, we take a break for lunch. Tuesday's break is provided by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, and salads that are made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Delivery is available nightly from 5 to 9. So thanks again to Bagby and Richard and Max. Please enjoy our lunch. Another hour of Midday.